I'm Helen Skelton and welcome to the Clean Energy Revolution. This series of podcasts is all about the role energy is playing in tackling the negative effects of climate change. The energy we use in our homes, offices, factories, shops, schools, hospitals, transport. The energy we use to fuel our everyday life. We'll look at what is already happening to make the energy we use to power our lives greener and cleaner, and what part we can all play as individuals, businesses, and nations in creating a more sustainable future. Today we're going to look at the potential for us to harness our energy offshore and the benefits of all this in terms of jobs and economic regeneration to coastal areas. The decarbonised industrial hubs planned for Teesside and Humber, and hydrogen is also a major part of the solution. Have a listen to our previous episode on hydrogen to hear more about that. So what is offshore energy? What is all the fuss about? And what is its potential for our future energy supply and getting to net zero? What innovations are taking place right now to get us to that point? I'll be joined by a few experts to find out exactly that and talk about the global impact and national stories. Well, I am delighted to be talking to Graham Cooper, Head of Future Markets at National Grid. Graham, we've chatted before. You spoke to us in our previous episode on transport. Good to chat to you, Graham.
Yeah, really good to talk to you again, Helen. Thank you.
So we want to know a bit more about the history of offshore energy because we use it, but do we use enough of it?
Oh, right. So it's a really, really good question. So let me look a little bit backwards before we look as to what we're going to see. So firstly, since the start of the Industrial Revolution, the country has made power by burning stuff. And historically, that's typically been coal. Then we got into gas, and then we did a bit of nuclear in the 70s, right? So the energy system has been trying to get cleaner. But in the last 20 years, it's taken a real huge step. So in 2018, as a country, we ended up making more power from non-dirty sources than from dirty sources. So wind, solar, nuclear, and not burning stuff to make electricity. So that's where we've come from. But the UK is the windiest place in Europe, and offshore is the windiest place in the UK. So as an island nation, we've kind of got the special sauce to do something big with offshore. And that's why really we're talking about the growth in offshore wind. It will be important. So about 20 years ago, people put an onshore wind turbine on a platform in the sea just to see what would happen. And it was just a good experiment, right? But what we realised is if you made wind turbines ready to be offshore, you could make them bigger because actually you've got the space in the sea. You could make them further away if you made them big enough to warrant a cable to shore. So over the last 20 years, we've really started to ramp that growth.
And in terms of that growth, some of that responsibility falls to you. What's the next bit for you when you think, right, okay, we've got to get more energy from offshore wind? How are you going to do that? What's your kind of must do?
So firstly, you need to know what you're aiming at. So what you've got is the Committee on Climate Change have observed that it's taken us 20 years to get to 10 gigawatts of offshore wind. Don't worry about what 10 gigawatts means, but to get to 10. And they've said to meet our climate targets by 2030, we've got to get to 40 gigawatts of offshore wind. So 20 years to get to 10 gigawatts. And now we've got 9 years to get to 40. So that's an additional 30 gigawatts of offshore wind. And that's a stepping stone to get to 2050, which is in excess of 100 gigawatts of wind. The Committee on Climate Change are an independent group employed by government to advise government on targets. So firstly, the scale is huge. The second thing to realise is it's of strategic importance to the country. The UK is one of the windiest places in Europe. So as a country, our biggest bet on going clean energy, or one of the biggest bets, is to have a foundation stone of that growth is clean energy into the energy system first. That will allow us to have clean transport, clean energy, clean industry. So we have to get this right. But that's where it gets really interesting, because National Grid doesn't make electricity. We don't buy electricity or don't sell electricity. We are just the conduit for that energy to get from where it's made to the big cities and the big conurbations in the UK for the local distribution companies to send that to your home. The offshore wind farm builds the wires in the sea. So to get to 40 gigawatts of offshore wind, we're going to need to spend probably somewhere in the order of about £10.5-11 billion on making sure the wires onshore are ready to take all that new power. Okay, so that needs a plan. And that plan needs to happen in a hurry, okay? On average, it takes us 9 years and 8 months to build a new pylon run. And you won't have to be a genius to know we've got less than 9 years and 8 months till 2030, where normally National Grid would have 3 or 4 big infrastructure projects going at any one time. We are now having to develop 15 large-scale bits of wire on top of the normal 4 that we would be doing, and do that by 2030. So this is, the scale is a huge step change. How we work, how we do planning, how we do stakeholder engagement, you know, talk to people about the wires that they may see, where those wires lie, are they overhead or underground, the impact of overhead or underground, mitigating measures to minimize their impact. But also we've got to think about a supply chain here. We're going to need enough overhead wire to go from here to Perth in Western Australia, 12,000 linear kilometres of overhead wire, okay? So this is not just that saying, well, we're going to think about where the wires go today and then tomorrow we'll think about planning and then tomorrow, you know, we have to think about everything in a hurry. And also we have to do that because don't forget, all the wires are ultimately paid by bill payers. So it's, you know, the cost of the grid is socialised to everybody who has a grid connection, everybody who has a light and power, right? So we need to do that at the cheapest possible cost for the UK. So we have to be very efficient and get organised.
What about the other effects on us as a country and individually? You know, I'm thinking about the look of the wires. Where will they go?
Most people's response is, can you just dig a hole and bury the wires? Well, the answer is, technically, we can. It's not entirely invisible. You can't build on top of it. It's difficult to plant trees on top of it. You know, but bearing in mind, I'll come back to the point that the cost of the grid network is socialized across everybody because we all need the power. If we bury it, it costs 8 times more than it does to put it on a pylon. Infrastructure, there is a view and a visual impact. How do we mitigate that? So can we plant trees to screen it? Can we put wider pylons, lower pylons? We automatically, in an area of outstanding natural beauty, so somewhere that's designated very, very pretty, our first presumption is to put it underground so we don't harm the view. But the trade-off is we need to make sure the power can move from where it's made to where it needs to get to, but we need to do that at lowest cost. Because ultimately, who's protecting consumers, bill payers, is Ofgem, the regulator. So they're an economic regulator. So we can't just decide to bury everything. The presumption is it's overhead first because that's the cheapest for bill payers. But we appreciate that there's a value in a view. There's the value in people's amenity, you know, the landscape that you have, the places you walk, the things that are near to you. But there's also a piece here, which is climate change is impacting everyone. We are actually all part of that energy transition. So if we're going to have electric cars and heat pumps in the future, we'll consume more energy in our homes. So that does need more wires, and those wires have to go somewhere. So we look to minimise their impact. We consult widely. It has to go through planning, just like anything else that needs to get built. But that trade-off, and people often miss, is yes, you can bury a lot of the wires, but that has a cost impact on everyone.
The scale and the speed at which you're having to do this is unprecedented. And that's because of the government targets. When you think about the impact on people and the emotions, you know, people have opinions on offshore wind farms. Yet the way you talk about all of this, there is clearly an element of excitement in your voice. Why are you so excited about the potential for offshore wind farm usage in this country?
So look, I'm going to be really honest with you at a personal level. I look at my children, and I've got a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old. They are looking to me as an individual, you know, as a dad, to make good choices and to do the right thing. But I have the additional ability to take me as a dad into my professional world. Anything is possible. It's just the right money, the right motivation, the right effort, right time to get in and get these things done. I have an electric car. I have ground source heat pumps. I used to build wind farms before I worked at National Grid. And what I'm trying to do is inject that enthusiasm. And it truly, truly is possible. If we can do this, We will make the right stepping stone to meet carbon budgets. We will benefit from clean air. We will all benefit from clean transport and clean heat. And as a country, we can then shine the light on other countries that said, look, we can do this. We'll help you. How can you do that? So there is always that argument that the UK is only a small percentage of global emissions, but you can't push others to do it unless you roll up your sleeves and do it yourselves. So bearing in mind, we're on the run down to COP26. This is the UK co-hosting the Global Climate Summit. We need to show our A game. I'm trying to show my A game as a parent and as an employee so that National Grid can help show its A game for the UK. And therefore, the UK can bring its A game for the planet.
Well, joining us now is Joe Northwood, the manager of offshore wind at National Grid. Joe's going to give us a bit more insight into the roadmap to change in the UK, the targets that we are yet to meet, and the impact that offshore might have on all of us. Joe, that sounds like a massive responsibility. When you hear those things, are you thinking, oh, wow, this is a big job, or come on, bring it on?
I would say I'm sat in the middle of the external world where the regulator and the government sit and our internal delivery team. So I've got a lot of delivery people within the business that are leading these projects and pulling together the programmes of work to actually deliver that infrastructure.
From your point of view, you and your peers and colleagues must be sitting there thinking, right, we've got these huge big targets, we need to get to net zero, but brilliant, we've got this massive big clean resource in that the UK is a very windy place. Is that exciting, or is the next thought, how are we going to harness and use all of that?
No, I think that it is a massive opportunity. I mean, we are blessed by the fact that we are an island, and with that comes an extensive coastline that we've got a lot of resources around us, whether that's tidal, whether it's wind. But on the flip side, we have to preserve that nature and the environment that we sit within. It's the double-edged sword of the fact that we need to build infrastructure now to protect and preserve that environment for the long term. And it's very much that investment now in a way that is responsible to make sure that it is an environment that is here for my generation and future generations to enjoy in the way that we can today.
Just to put that into context for people, it's all good and well having wind as a resource, but if you can't get it into people's homes, there's no point having it, is there? So how challenging is it to put that infrastructure in place so that we can use the resource we have?
Harnessing that wind offshore in the environment is a very challenging environment to deliver infrastructure. And I think we're partnering with industries that have capability. So the oil and gas sectors that have previously been well-versed with building platforms out in deep sea are now using their skills and capabilities to put infrastructure in clean and renewable energy. There's lots of subsea cabling and sort of laying a lot of things that you don't see that connects the wind farm to get the energy onto the shoreline, and making sure that we don't do that from a single wind farm to a single cable and minimise how many landing points we have across the East Coast to manage that visual impact as much as we do get the benefit from the offshore wind. The biggest challenge at the moment is the coordination and a scale that is so large across sectors and geographies that needs a sort of central view as to where are these things going to connect and land. And that's one thing that we are really actively pushing for and contributing within to get the certainty of where all of this infrastructure should be placed.
You guys are working at an unprecedented scale and speed in terms of the number of projects that you're doing. Who are you having those conversations with?
There's a lot of stakeholders involved in this, whether that's those developers that are building the wind turbines or coordinating the offshore project, principally the government, whose target we are trying to achieve here and enable the delivery of that 40 gigawatts by 2030. This is setting the direction in a way that will enable us to deliver that. We're having the conversations with the government, principally the business, energy and industrial strategy departments, with our regulator to make sure that we have those frameworks in place that allow us to spend money in a way that is in the interests of consumers. We're all pointing towards that net zero target now, and we all have to ensure that we are delivering that target whilst managing the needs and interests of all of those stakeholders and making sure that we can do so in a way that's economic and efficient and not just building infrastructure for the sake of it. And making sure that we do so in a responsible way.
So clearly, without doubt, offshore is going to have an impact on all of us, But it's fair to say it may well be necessary to keep our world alive. Alid Rowlands from National Grid is here now to tell us a bit more about the benefits to our communities and address some of those concerns that this energy source could have. Alid, we've heard a lot about infrastructure and pipes, and to people who aren't fully versed in what that means, does it mean there's going to be huge pipes going underneath everybody's roads and paths and fields, or there's going to be huge cables in the air?
So there's going to be an enormous amount of energy coming off the east coast of England, which is fantastic news. And getting that energy to the homes and businesses that need to use it, you know, is part of our role. And when you think of it, we're changing where that energy is coming from. So it used to come from coal fields in the north, down kind of coming down south, or coal fields in the west coming east. But now we're changing. It's coming from the east of England. So we will work with the developers. We will work with UK government. We will work with industry partners to make those impacts as little as we possibly can. And we will explain how people can have an influence of that as well. But it doesn't mean zero impact. And try and do that as sensitively as we can, and try and do that in a way that is most effective and efficient for those communities that are going to be affected.
When you say those communities, what parts of the country and how much of the country are going to see change and see these substations, for instance?
It would be wrong just to think about this as something that the East Coast is going to affect, because you know, the energy needs to go right across the country. So there are places that we need to improve our network all across. Our projects will be from right kind of the bottom in the southeast of England all the way up to the Humber and all the way through Scotland as well, from those the industry in Scotland. But it does go further inland as well, because as I say, it's not just about getting that energy on land, as it were. It then needs to get to our cities, our towns, our homes, businesses, hospitals and all the rest of it, which is everywhere.
So clearly a lot of infrastructure and some disruption, but how much impact is it going to have on people's day-to-day lives? Are they going to notice you digging up roads and putting up pylons?
It depends exactly where those projects will be. For the vast majority of the people in the UK, they won't know any different. They, you know, it's not going to affect them where they are. But that's not to kind of minimise those people who are affected. Of course, it affects them, but the work needs to be done. So even if we are only affecting a small number of people, those people are obviously going to be wanting to talk to us and giving their views about how we affect them.
That's what I was going to ask you about. How much energy and effort do you guys put into reassuring people and explaining what's going on?
We have a number of steps in order to bring people in, to explain what our plans are and to give them a chance to have an influence on those plans as well. So we have rounds of what we call consultation in order to go out and explain to people our latest plans and to show them how they can affect and change those plans. But there's a balance in there, because we have to consider a number of different things that the government tell us that we need to consider. So we need to consider cost, for starters. So lots of people tell us, well, stick it underground. We know it'll be an impact on us immediately, but it'll be a long-term impact, so we won't be able to see pylons. But that has other issues with it. First off, it costs a lot more. But secondly, you know, it's things like, you know, we're digging up a lot of land, so there's a biodiversity impact as well. On the other end of the scale, by putting up pylons, by putting up overhead lines, it costs less, but there's a visual impact that will stay there for many years to come. So it is that balance that we need to address. Government give us very strong guidelines on, you know, what we should do and how we should be doing that, as well as local people as well. So we'll often say to local people, these are our plans, this is what we're thinking, how can you make this better? How can you tell us that we can improve what we're doing in this area?
The other concern that people have is, you know, beyond the impact on their immediate environment, is cost. All of this comes at a huge cost, and that will be passed on to the bill payer, won't it?
It is. All the work that we do does eventually get onto energy bill payers, and that's why we call it effective and efficient. When we start to look at projects, we don't start by saying, right then, what do we need to build? We start by saying, what do we have already that we can reversion? What's the new kit that we can put in that gets this energy to where we need it? And a lot of that is pointing towards cost. It's also about impact as well as, you know, being a responsible business, that we want to do that the least impact we can. So cost is a major part. It's only one of the things we consider, you know, next to technical capabilities and the environment and the views of local people.
Huge scale, huge ambition, inevitable challenges, but it would be remiss of me to not point out the obvious opportunities that comes with putting all of this pipework and this infrastructure in. How can those immediate communities benefit from all this work?
So when you look at, you know, over £10 billion worth of projects, we need people to do that. And it's not just Those, you know, large corporations, but it, you know, it's people who are going to be digging trenches, it's people manufacturing cables, but also other jobs. You know, we need people who are lawyers, who are specialised in planning permissions. We need land agents who are good at talking to people about the way we use their land. So, you know, we're looking at that really carefully about how we can ensure we play our part in those green jobs, that our part in COVID recovery, and making sure that those areas where we are developing schemes that might be impacted, those are the areas as well that they can see their young people or even older people getting jobs that benefit from this energy transition. So it is not just about the future generations who are going to benefit from this societal change, this transformation, but we're pushing very hard to think about ways that the societies that are going to be impacted will themselves directly benefit from the enormous amount of work that's required.
And there's obvious benefits like the local hotel having a load of contractors in, the local sandwich shop getting loads of trade, obvious and immediate benefits. But actually, you must feel very proud that you're contributing to a skill set that is world leading as well.
We've got a jump start on the rest of the world in some of these areas. And it's a great opportunity for us in National Grid to be able to use those skills and those abilities. But it's going to be longer than just as well. You know, we're looking out to 2050 through net zero. And you'd say, well, that's probably long enough. You know, 30 years is a long time, don't we all know? But there's other parts of the world as well will be doing the same journey as us. And we can benefit from that as a nation.
But of course, offshore isn't as simple as popping a few wind farms in the North Sea. Maurice Bray is the man leading the charge to deliver multi-purpose interconnector projects and connect the UK with clean energy around the world. He's here with me now. Is that fair to say? Is that your role? Are you leading the charge to deliver multi-purpose interconnector projects, Maurice?
Hi, Helen. It is a very grand... very grand title, but we're promoting this as a new step in the direction to integrate more renewables, so we can make more of the technologies that we're familiar with and make more wind accessible to consumers. That's, yeah, so I guess we are leading the charge.
Talking of making things accessible to consumers, what is a multi-purpose interconnector project?
Right, well, should I start first of all trying to explain about interconnectors, and then I can go on to maybe say a bit about multi-purpose interconnectors. Maybe that might help. So because we're an island, connections with other countries need to be with a different grid technology. So we use direct current technology, or DC, if we want to connect to Ireland or to continental Europe. And that requires a conversion process at each end, which is sort of like a large-scale version of your charger for your phone. An interconnector is a combination of those conversion processes at each end and cables in between, because as we're an island, the electrical connections have to be by subsea cables. We're currently operating four, and we will be operating six interconnectors to our European neighbours over the next 3 years. So multi-purpose interconnectors take that a step forward and try and use the technology to also connect in offshore wind. And by doing so, we can minimise the amount of infrastructure that's actually needed.
Given what has happened politically over the last few years, why are we building a load of infrastructure to share things with Europe?
Well, very good point. I mean, the climate emergency is not just a country specific issue, it's not even a regional issue, it's a global issue. And despite politics and despite the situation that we're in, we're in a region in Northwest Europe where we have got resources that we can actually share. The UK has got fantastic offshore renewables resources that it can try to harvest. That's what we're trying to do in the UK, but equally our neighbours in Belgium and Netherlands and France and Denmark and Norway, Germany are all trying to do the same thing, all trying to have a common goal. So we need to do that efficiently, and we need to do that sensitively with respect to the environment. And so that one of the best ways of doing that is to actually share the resource. The scale of the challenge is so big that we've really got to collaborate and do things together. And that's where joining up more with our European neighbours is going to be more and more important. And connecting offshore wind that is shareable is also going to be more important. so it reduces impacts for members of the public, regardless of which country they're in.
So, as Maurice said, we are ready to work together with European countries to make clean energy via offshore a reality. But what about the global picture and what is happening internationally? Kerry Maddock is head of NG Ventures Strategy. She's here to speak with me now about the picture in the States. Good morning, Kerry.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we've talked a lot about offshore in the North Sea. What is the picture in the States? Are you using it? Is there, well, there's obviously potential.
There is a huge potential for offshore wind in the US. We are really early days. There are five offshore wind turbines just off Rhode Island that National Grid had a part in bringing online, a very small part, but a really exciting adventure. But that's all we have right now. But putting into context how ambitious we are about getting offshore wind, kind of the market develops in the US. We've got about 35 gigawatts of offshore winds globally, and the Atlantic coast currently has ambitions of getting almost 34 gigawatts online before 2035. So I think people in the US have recognized we have an amazing resource. I know in New England and New York, offshore wind is a much better resource for us from a clean energy, renewable energy standpoint than we have in terms of onshore resources, kind of solar and onshore wind. So people are really looking at offshore wind as kind of the next big thing in our clean energy transition.
So clearly the potential is there, but is the will to make it happen? Because you've got to have people who are willing to accept all that infrastructure to get the energy into houses on land.
Absolutely. So the will is absolutely there. I think these targets and ambitions, this 34 gigawatts that I have referenced, is coming from state mandates. So it really is our government recognizing that if we want to reach a clean energy future, we need to take advantage of this resource that we have off our coast. And people really are on board, right? There's been some issues kind of getting the first couple of projects online and getting them landed and people getting comfortable with will they be able to see the turbines? Will they kind of land on the coast? But I think there's a general movement, especially on the East Coast, that this is kind of a necessary next step in our clean energy transition. There's lots of places, things that need to fall in line. We've got to build the supply chain. We've got to build a whole industry, but I think people are really excited. It comes with lots of jobs, lots of opportunities. So, you know, where there's a will, there's a way, and we are making it happen here.
Just touching on that will of the people, because obviously in the UK, offshore wind farms are not a new thing. They've been debated, the good, the bad, the ugly, the opportunities, the challenges. But obviously it's not something that you guys are used to. Is it something that people are like, oh, this could be exciting? Or is it like, what is that going to look like?
You know, it's a bit of a mix. I think in general, people are really positive and it hasn't been too hard to get these ambitions put through into state laws. People are supportive of this, especially in kind of the East Coast. The culture here is a lot more focused on climate change. But there has been some challenges. You know, we're trying to sort out how all of these offshore wind farms are going to interact with the fishermen, where they're going to land on the coast, making sure that the beaches and the environment, kind of where these the big wires need to land, still, you know, come in and everything still is pretty and prestigious. But we're working through that slowly but surely. We are getting there. The wind farms will be far enough offshore that you won't see many of them, or you'll see them in the very far distance. So people are just starting to get comfortable with what they could look like.
Because the picture in America is very different to the picture in the UK. Am I right in saying that the US market is about 10 years behind the UK?
Yes, we are absolutely a decade behind. But in some ways, that's a really exciting opportunity for us. To put it in kind of context, when the first wind farm went in Europe in 1991, the wind turbines were only 0.45 megawatts. The technology has advanced so significantly that we're putting in wind turbines now that are 8 megawatts. They're going up to 12 megawatts. We're building ones now that are 15 megawatts. So we really get to take so much of that learning that happened in Europe over the last decade. So much of the understanding on technology, the understanding how to connect these projects to the grid, the understanding of building them in the ocean, the impacts on fisheries, the impacts on the seabed. America gets to benefit from all of that. And so that's why you see these so ambitious targets when you think of how long it took Europe and the North Sea to get to these levels, you know, of the 30 megawatts and how the US thinks it's going to be able to do it. It's because of that technology and learning that we get to have from Europe. And when you really look at the players coming over to the US and who's participating in the market, it's all those European utilities with that learning coming over here and bringing that knowledge, partnering with local players here, and building up that industry with 10 years of experience.
Realistically, how quickly, in what decade, could New York be powered by wind?
It is probably not a goal to have offshore wind be the 100%, you know, power source. The goal for New York is that by 2040, all of the power sources are clean energy, zero emitters. So no offset, zero emitters by 2040 is the New York goal. That needs to be a mix of resources to keep the system reliable. So they're looking right now to have 9 gigawatts of offshore wind on by 2035. We expect that goal to increase over time, but they'll also be relying on hydro from Canada, from onshore solar and onshore wind. We're going to need battery technology to enhance. We're going to need probably hydrogen to provide a fuel source that can give us the same kind of mechanics that gas-fired generation gives us now, which is significant reliability, the ability to turn it on really quickly, to make up for any intermittency that we see, right? If the wind's not blowing, we can't be 100% reliant on wind unless we kind of have a backup reserve. Batteries and hydrogen can go a far way, but we'll want to make sure that we have a mix. We'll still rely on some of the nuclear facilities that are online. But you always want a, you know, a healthy mix to make sure that we can keep the system reliable.
Well, that is all we have time for today. We've heard about the pros and cons of offshore wind, the benefits of the North Sea as a starting point, the impact this will have on our communities, and the importance of countries working together to make the most of the energy we're creating. Thank you to all of our guests on this episode for giving up their time and their fantastic insight. I'm Helen Skelton, and I'll be back again with another episode of The Clean Energy Revolution. You can follow this podcast on your favourite app to make sure you hear that. In the meantime, if you want to find out more about what National Grid is doing to work towards our clean energy future, everything you need to know is at nationalgrid.com.